Pacific time. And then we couldn't find another 4-hour slot. So we're going to meet December 3rd and 4th. On the 3rd from 12 to 2 Pacific time, and then on the 4th from 9 to 11 Pacific time. Understanding that some people may only be able to make one of those 2-hour meetings. So it's the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th, 9 a.m. to 1, 12 to 2, 9 to 11. Okay, so everybody mark that on their calendars and we will do that. Now, Jill will be sending out a request because we'll need progress reports prior to that meeting. And it'll be done in the same format we've done in the past. And so look for that and try to prepare to get those progress reports into us. I want to thank everybody for dealing with the CFAS 4 budget response, budget questions that NIAAA was asking for. We put all those together. We sent them in, and I think it's something that we should seriously think about and give a lot of thought to in case we have any further additions or suggestions to NIAAA. And I'm assuming that they would be open to any ideas that we might have how to get CFAS 4 completed, see what's perhaps on the agenda for CFAS 5. Bill, you got any comments, or Joe, you got any comments that you want to do about that?
I think the only comment we could provide right now is just to thank everyone. I think we're doing our, Joe and I are doing our due diligence here, exploring some options. And right now, I think we're kind of in the initial stages and making some of the assessments. So thanks everyone for providing as much detail as you did. Joe, do you have any other?
No, thank you. I really appreciate that and everyone.
Well, I think that the investigator should probably have a talk without NIAAA on the call at one time to talk about the various options, and not options, but we don't know what the options are, but to talk about the possibility, you know, the process and how, what we can do to try to meet CFAS 4 goals and yet move forward during this time, particularly not knowing when all of this is going to end. You know, I think that's a major stumbling block when things return back to semi-normal, at least. So we'll see how it goes today. Maybe we can take 5 minutes at the end and do that if there are no objections to that. All right, so on today's agenda, Claire and Therese have been working hard on the adult health study, trying to collect as much data as possible during this period of COVID. And I saw some data that Claire sent me, and I thought it would be of interest for everyone to see it. So I don't know how you want to break it up, if Claire and Therese are both going to talk, or Claire, you want to go to it, start it off? You're muted.
I have a presentation I'm just going to give, and Therese and I can both answer questions, but I need to be able to share slides. So do I have permission to do that, Jill?
She says yes.
Okay.
Yes. So the green button, yep.
Green button, screen two. Are you getting that, or?
Nope.
Okay, share. How about now?
Yep.
Okay. There's a lot of, as it turns out, a great deal of data, more than I thought I'd have at this point. So I'm going to sort of rush through.
Claire, yep. Go ahead and do swap display so we can see the full.
Go ahead and do what?
Go ahead and display settings at the top. Over to the left. Display settings.
Settings, yes.
Yes. and do swap. There you go. Yep, there you go.
You are so good. Thank you. I'm going to go through this quickly because I turned out to have more information than I actually thought I would at this point in time. And this was done from the first cut of the data I pulled in order to do a presentation at the Proof Alliance last week, just on. And so here is a preliminary report on the self-reported data. This is only a portion of what we're doing. Okay. And as you will all recall, this is the tier, I'm going to talk, there were two tiers. Tier one is an adult health survey, which we're hoping to get 500 people for. It's going to be a chore with COVID. And it involves a survey, and then we have a demographic survey as well. And we have a number of health issues that are addressed in this survey, some of which are listed here. And I'm going to talk about these. And just in brief, we at this point have 255 cases. And thanks a great deal to the very energetic people in Seattle, I might add. And the average age is around 39, 40 years old. More women than men, a nice distribution of races, although most are non-Hispanic. Significantly different effects of education, and I didn't put I do have a listing at this point of all the occupations, so I'm going to turn this into a Hollingshead rating, but I haven't done it yet. Individuals who are alcohol affected are more likely to be unmarried and to have lower income. When we ask them, and again, remember, this is self-reported data. This is what they're telling me or telling us about how they understand their own health. So one of the overall questions at the beginning is, do you think of yourself in good health and in good mental health, physical mental health? And those who are alcohol affected report significantly less often that they think of themselves in good physical mental health. And then we went into specific problems, and we just, this is a systems check, basically. And everybody wears glasses, apparently, but there are more problems with hearing and dental issues with individuals who are alcohol exposed. The alcohol exposed individuals report significantly more loss of teeth, which is not good at this age. And probably, I would suspect that's related to access to healthcare. Cardiovascular issues is one of the things we're really interested here because of the developmental hypothesis of disease, developmental origins of disease hypothesis that we're working on. And so we ask about questions about cardiovascular function. One was, did you have health problems as a child? Do you have health problems now? And do you have high blood pressure? And as you can see, pretty much overall, with this sample, which is not complete, we're showing that the alcohol-affected individuals report more cardiac problems and higher blood pressure as adults. These are percentages, by the way. So this is the percentages of individuals who report this. Thus, some people don't report it and have no problems, but there's a higher percentage reporting. Another area we looked at was gastrointestinal problems. Hadn't even been, we just asked this. And we're finding more people with alcohol exposure report problems with digestion and regular problems with bowels. And this is an interesting area. I had not, again, this is sort of a novel. More kidney stones, more bladder infections, really a lot more bladder infections and urinary tract problems. And a much higher incidence of incontinence, urinary incontinence in the alcohol-affected individuals. We were very interested in diabetes and metabolic syndrome, and we remain so, but it is not quite there yet, because you see there's a trend toward them being having been diagnosed, and the question here has a medical professional diagnosed you as? And there's a tendency toward more in the pre-diabetic. The diabetic is not yet significant. Julie, when we looked at this, says that they actually don't know what's going on with their bodies, which is possible. Another question was, have you medical professional diagnosed who's having an endocrine thyroid disorder? And here we find that there's a higher frequency of alcohol exposed individuals so diagnosed.
Does that break down in terms of male, female, Claire?
I have the majority of the individuals here are female, and I can break that out. I have not done so in this presentation, just in terms of time, but yes, I can definitely do that.
I had the same question for the urinary tract infections.
Yeah, it's an important issue. And that's going to add into all of these analyses. Again, as I said, this is a first cut of this. It's very preliminary. We also ask about allergies, skin problems, and autoimmune disorders. And again, you're seeing a higher number of those who are alcohol affected being diagnosed with these, although it's not quite there with autoimmune. I looked at the specific autoimmune disorders that we asked about, and the only one in which we see really higher reporting in the alcohol group is arthritis. And it's so much higher that I'm pretty sure this will, if we broke it out and just looked at that, we'd get significant effects. Another thing which was quite striking was we asked, have you had cancer? And 10 people had had cancer. Specifically, no controls that had it. Seems to have spelled control wrong. We ask about seizure disorders. More individuals with alcohol exposure had seizure disorders. And then we looked at mental health disorders in general. And these are ADHD, depression, bipolar disorder, anxiety, and psychotic behavior, including schizophrenia. With the exception of the psychoses, the alcohol group has significantly higher rates of diagnosed mental health disorders. So, again, since we're on 20 minutes, I'm rushing through a lot of things. But one of the questions, how can we understand what this means? Is it just that prenatal alcohol exposure is a direct cause of negative health and mental health outcomes? Seems simplistic. Is prenatal alcohol exposure simply associated with health and mental health outcomes that are determined by other things? And is prenatal alcohol exposure one of many factors? So what information do we have from this questionnaire that I could easily access? And one was prenatal alcohol exposure, yes, no. One was biological sex, as you mentioned. One is race, another is race, ethnicity. Educational level, which here I'm using as a proxy for social status. And access to healthcare, including type of healthcare. And then the other thing. Another issue was adverse childhood experiences. So let me show you briefly. This is the access to healthcare. They're not reporting difference in access, but there's a difference in type, so that the alcohol group is more likely to have Medicaid or similar insurance rather than insurance through a job or private. This is a very important issue. We ask about adverse childhood experiences, and the total, and added up the total of these 11 factors, finding that, of course, the alcohol group, particularly the females, had much higher rates of adverse childhood experiences. And those things which are on the right side of the screen, which are in white, are those things which are significantly different between the groups. And they have to do with custody, substance use disorders by the caregivers, incarceration, separation, and physical and verbal and sexual abuse. So we looked, I did some regression, very quick and dirty recessions on mental health disorders, and just added up all the mental health. Did you have any mental health disorder? Finding that prenatal alcohol exposure itself was not significant. The significant differences were biological sex and whether or not the individual had experienced adverse childhood experiences. So it was, these things were associated with the prenatal exposure, but it looks like it is the associated factors which are are most highly related. So I looked more specifically at particular diagnosis, and here we have depression, anxiety disorder, and ADHD. And what it looks like is you get diagnosed with depression if you've had a really bad childhood and you have health insurance. You get diagnosed with anxiety disorder if you are of a different social class, you have health insurance and you had a bad childhood. However, ADHD is directly related to prenatal alcohol exposure, or directly related. It is significant in the regression model, as is sex, but the prenatal, the postnatal environmental stressors were not related to it. So it is going to turn out to be much more complicated than it's just alcohol exposure. It's going to turn out that there are some things that appear more directly associated, and there's some things in which there's probably moderating factors or mediating factors. I decided to do the same thing with the medical diagnosis and picked cancer and thyroid disorders, since they were very strongly related. And here we find that cancer diagnosis is more common in those who are prenatally exposed to alcohol, had childhoods with greater adversity, which undoubtedly related to stress, and who don't have health insurance. So presumably they are not getting early signs of cancer checked. We don't know that, that's an assumption. Similarly, I looked at thyroid disorder, and again, finding a relationship between prenatal alcohol exposure and stress, childhood stressors. So again, I think that when we really have a chance to comb through this and do complex models with the whole sample, we're gonna find very interesting relationships among these different diseases and the outcomes. So that's the quick talk. And I'll be happy to answer any questions, and I know that Therese will be too.
I want to thank Claire and Therese for putting this data together and collecting it in the first place, because I know it's not been easy. And I think it's giving us more information than we've ever had before about the aging process. And you have to remember that these individuals are not all that old. What is up to 45 or something?
Well, the average age is around 40 or close to 40, and they range anywhere from 30s to late 40s. There may be a few in the Seattle sample who are older.
So I've got a couple, or at least one question. Other developmental disabilities are associated with increased health risk.
Would you speak louder, Ed, because for some reason you're not getting through to me very loudly.
Other developmental disabilities are associated with increased risk for health effects.
Right.
And I'm wondering, you're using fairly standard measures, and I'm wondering, relative to other developmental disabilities, whether alcohol is particular in its impact or effect, or having greater than having like a diagnosis such as Asperger's or autism or something like that, where there's also increases in health complications?
It's a really important question, and I think that one that we will look into.
The data must be out there. I mean, because your questionnaires are fairly standard, right?
Well, the questionnaire is very standard. It's one used, we modified the CDC's questionnaire. And I was going to, once we got the sample collected, look at it against the data the CDC had collected. But I can check and see whether they're collecting specific data related to disabilities.
And Dr. Hannigan, didn't you find some thyroid effects one time?
He acts like he doesn't hear you.
Dr. Hannigan. You there? Oh, he's taking a break. He got caught. All right. Any other questions?
Ed, I had a comment. Just wondering, Claire, I think there is a big, there's a linkage between thyroid problems and teeth problems. So, there might be actually something that's connected biologically rather than only by health availability or something like that.
Yeah, and we didn't put all the possible variables in there.
Claire, it's Michael. I think Deepak Sarkar published a paper a number of years ago, might have been in PNAS, looking at prenatal alcohol exposure in breast cancer. Mm-hmm. And maybe another cancer as well, that might have been even transgenerational. I can't remember the details of it. But that's an interesting finding, and it may tie into, you know, an alteration in immune surveillance or something else that could be correlated. So that'll be interesting to follow up on, because that was a fairly striking effect.
It was. And again, I'm just taking what people are telling me at this point. So, and I didn't know exactly how this was all going to turn out because we were simply doing descriptions. So we'll see. I was sort of startled by some of these things.
And when they say that they have arthritis, is that just how the question is posed? Do you have arthritis, or do we know anything more about the kind of arthritis they might have? Because at that age, it would be unusual to have much osteoarthritis.
You asked rheumatoid arthritis,
and yeah, you didn't see a difference in rheumatoid arthritis, or not much,
not as much.
Rheumatoid
arthritis, yeah. But again, I don't think the N is very big as yet in this.
Yeah.
I'll just, Claire, that's really a spectacular set of data. And just to follow up, we don't have a tier one. There's no way in BC we could have built a data set of 500. Or I guess we could have gone further out, but Claire is covering that. We have tier two, so it's a much smaller N. It's a total N of 72, 28 of whom are controls. So it's a little harder to find significant differences yet, but we mimic, in our smaller sample, we find basically everything that Claire has found, except for cancer, that's not higher, but huge number of digestive problems, kidney problems, diabetes, 7% versus 0 in the controls. Thyroid problems, 14% versus 0 in the controls. Asthma, preclinical signs of autoimmune disease. Epilepsy, psychotic disorders, 4% have schizophrenia or psychotic disorders versus 0. Depression and anxiety, bipolar. So even with a very small sample where not everything is statistically significant yet, we basically mirror Claire's findings. We can maybe add some of our data into your overall data set, although you have to control for race, ethnicity, all of those things, which you need to do at some point anyway.
Yeah,
but anyway, just to say, these individuals are in trouble.
At any of the sites, is it possible to get access to electronic health records?
So that's the one. That's the one bonus that we have in British Columbia.
To verify the self-report data.
Right.
Actual medical conditions.
Right. So that's the one thing we can do, and all of our people have access to healthcare in British Columbia, although some of them don't seek it very aggressively or don't see a doctor, even though they can. So, but that's a difference. We can get that. And that number, the health number, is linked to an education number and pharmacy records of what medications they have. So ultimately we can track that down.
Yeah, I think that would be a good thing to try to do it at all the sites.
Well, we are trying to do it, and it's part of what we're trying to do. Now, there are two problems. Number one, half of our people don't have doctors, and then when we get the records, we've actually gotten some records, and it's a huge, gigantic job, and we probably don't have the resources to do it adequately, because you don't just send, there's not just one provider, and there's not just one system to get it from. So it would be a lot of work. So we found it not to be as satisfactory as we had hoped in terms of getting the records. I think Teresa's had the same problem, haven't you?
Yeah, in Seattle, we have also begun trying to collect medical records. And as Claire said, it's complicated because people have such different types of medical providers. The release of information process is different for everyone. So it's been very complicated to get records. And the records that we have received are, as Claire said, they're not very complete. They're all very different from each other. And it's surprising how sparse the medical records are.
Yeah,
this is Mike.
This
is Mike. I just was going to mention that, it's a different kind of study, but Olivia Weeks, who looked previously at the Mass General Brigham record system to extract people with a diagnosis of FASD and then look at metabolic issues, is looking now at heart issues. And it'll be interesting, you know, starting with a comprehensive record, but without the sort of uniform diagnostic criteria that you've all used, whether she finds something similar in terms of heart disease, because that was another finding that you showed, Claire, that was quite striking when you looked at heart disease per se.
Yeah.
And in a young population like this.
No.
Exactly. We have the same thing. They had heart disease as kids and they have heart issues now.
Remember, these are frequencies I gave you. So it's only a percentage of people who have these things.
Right. That's where we are too.
Any other questions? Yeah, Bill.
Yeah, so Claire, Therese, thanks for a great presentation and the interesting data. I think this was maybe the first time that I had seen the last couple slides where you were trying to model the contributions of these things to each condition. And I was wondering if you could say a little bit more in terms of how far you want to take that approach. How complex do you want to make these models?
I think that in order to understand what we're really looking at, we're going to have to do that. We're going to have to include social class and resources, financial resources, sex, and whatever else we can find that can contribute to understanding these things as much as we can, because these are very, very highly impacted groups in terms not only of their developmental disability, but also frequently social factors, and we would be foolish to ignore those. And the people in Atlanta, for instance, are predominantly African American and have few resources and often don't have good access to health care. I'm perfectly sure that's contributing to a lot of things. So if we don't do that, we're not going to be accurate what we're talking about. So definitely we need to do that.
And
the other confirmatory factor I want to add is that Julie, as you know, is looking at a subset of this group and looking at doing actual physical examination, blood work, and so on with the individuals. And that will help when we can compare that to their reports. It's not everybody, but it's going to give us a subsample that we can see how accurately they're reporting their status.
All right, we're going to have to move on, but I want to thank Claire and Therese for all the work that they've put in doing this. I know it's not easy, and Joanne as well.
It's particularly not easy with COVID, I might say.
Nothing is really easy with COVID, except living at home.
No.
But we have another presentation today.
So I just have to interrupt for 1 second because I'm struck by what you've just said, Claire, which is the high prevalence of African Americans in your sample and the high prevalence of hypertension, heart disease, maybe prediabetes. And everything that we're learning about increased morbidity, mortality, and COVID in people of color is in part related to these comorbidities. And so I just wonder if you're in a position to tease out looking at ethnicity and your comparable control groups.
Yes, I can do that.
How much of this is alcohol and how much of this is just the very high prevalence of these comorbid conditions in African Americans and Blacks?
Absolutely have to do that. You're right. And I think there's a higher, we'll end up with a higher percentage between the Seattle sample and the people that Joanna's working with of Native Americans as well.
Yeah. Thank you. Sorry to interrupt.
That's no problem. All right, Sarah, you ready to go?
I'm ready. So Ed asked me to present a little bit on our online test, which you've heard me talk about a little bit before, but we have now about 2 months of, we've been administering it for 2 months. I don't have any data to share with you because we are working on the process of getting the data out of the test and into a form that we can analyze. What we're doing is we're hoping to put it into a framework like the decision tree app that we have, where we export the data from the online test, and in the process of importing it, all the calculations are done, and we get feedback out of how the individual performed on the test. So we're and that's moving along. We're making progress on that. So I'm hoping that by December we'll have at least some preliminary data to share when we meet sort of in person. So what I thought I'd do is show you a little bit of what it's like to take the test. I toyed with sending you all a link and collecting data from you, but I thought that might actually be sort of mean. But I thought I would show you, put together just a video of what the test is like. So I'm going to share my screen if I have permission to do so. Looks like I do. Make sure I share the right one. Okay, can you see the video screen?
Yes.
Okay, I see nodding. All right, so it's about a 5-minute video, but I'm not gonna show it continuously because I thought I would stop and tell you a little bit about each test. And in the interest of full disclosure, my daughter helped me make the movie, and she put music on the background of the movie. But I'm fairly certain that it's not going to show up. Hopefully. We'll see. Okay, so we start the screen with a consent document, which I didn't show you, and then a very brief survey that the parent completes, where we ask about very basic demographic information. The test is collected without any identifying information. So it doesn't even collect IP address of the computer. So we're able to collect it in an anonymous way. So after the initial screen, which I, sorry, went by a little bit fast, we ask a few behavioral questions. The parent answers these questions. And these are, selected from, you know, our extensive data set, where we've asked questions like from the CBCL, Child Behavior Checklist, over many, many years. And at some point in our history, we've looked at the questions on our various questionnaires that are the best predictors of alcohol exposure. And so we put those here in the beginning of our survey. And it's actually on one page, but I couldn't make it come up on one page. So there's a few more on the next page. And then the parent has the child start the testing. So the first test is a finger tapping test. So I should say that all the tests that we have put into the Brain Online, and there are 7 of them, are based on traditional tests. So these are, we use tests that we, or we base our tests on tests that we knew were good predictors of alcohol effects. We included some basic tests like finger tapping, and then we have some that are a little more complex. So in a finger tapping test, this is not a good test to show you by video, but you're actually tapping the space bar as fast as you can between the go and the stop. And every task in Brain Online has a practice. So you do the practice test and then you do the real thing. So for finger tapping, you tap, you do practice and then you tap with your right hand for 5 trials. And then you do a practice and tap with your left hand for 5 trials. So this one's gonna go by kind of fast because there's nothing really to see. So you do your right hand and then you do the real thing. That was the practice. Then you do your left hand and then at the end of every task, you there's a sort of a, I don't know, my daughter called it an affirmation screen. So something nice, you know, the person has completed the task and they're ready to move on to the next thing. I should also add that they can stop and start at any time during the task. Of course, we hope that they don't stop and start in the middle of a task, but for example, they could stop here and then come back to it. And in fact, they can even change devices as long as they log in with the same code and it will just start again where they left off. So the next task is a reaction, a standard reaction time task, and all they're doing is responding to a star. And again, there's a practice and then the real trial. So that's what the star looks like. We also, during the practice, give them feedback. If they respond too quickly, like I have visions of a child just sort of, you know, banging on the keyboard, we tell them, you know, to wait until they see the star. If they wait too long, we tell them, we try to correct that too. And these are things, you know, that we would normally do if we were performing this type of task in a laboratory setting, face-to-face or in a clinical setting. But here, the person is doing it unsupervised. Parents are told that they can sort of help their child with the process, but they can't help them with the task. We did have one parent who actually completed the task. We didn't anticipate this, but she went through the beginning and she didn't realize that she was supposed to have her child do the task. So after completing the questionnaires, she actually went ahead and did the task. So she told us right away and we deleted it and and her child will complete the task. So again, there's this affirmation screen at the end of the second task. And we move on to the third task, which is a response inhibition task. In this task, there are arrows, right and left facing arrows, and you press the space bar when you see the right facing arrow, but not the left facing arrow. There are 50 right facing arrows, 50 left facing arrows. There's also a practice with correction, and they only get correction during the practice. I have speeded this up a little bit. The stimuli stay on for about a second, I think. See, that's a little fast just to get through the task. So then the next task is a memory task. So this task, I really like this task. It's quite challenging, but so in this video, I'm not going to show you the whole thing because it takes a few minutes, but Matthew Hyland, my project coordinator, completed. He's the one who's been working with the polishing of this task, and I've taken this task many, many times, but he's taken it way more than me, and you'll see he doesn't get anything wrong, and that's not the way it usually is. It's a really quite a challenging task. On this, it's a 16 square grid. There's 14 cards and 2 blanks, and they each come up during the learning, the initial exposure phase. And then you're asked to show, you know, where the card is, and you get feedback on the first 3 learning trials. So this is an example of the exposure part of the task. You're shown where every card is. They always stay in the same place. And now you're given 5 seconds to respond for each tap, for each card. And you get positive feedback if you get it right, or you get corrected if you get it wrong. That's the only one he got wrong of all the 3. So I made sure to include that. And after the 3 learning trials, you the last trial, the probe trial, we show the cards, but you don't get any feedback. And you go through all the trials again with no feedback. Okay, so then we do tell them that after they complete a few more tasks, we will ask them again about the cards. Okay, so this is a standard flanker task. If you're familiar with the attention network task, this is a very similar task to that. You respond there's a line of fish, you'll see them on the screen, and you respond about which direction the fish is facing using the keyboard keys on your computer. And again, we always start with practice and give correction during the practice. And it does go fairly quickly. So that was practice, now this is the real thing. And you respond, some of the fish are swimming by themselves, then they're neutral, and some of the fish are flanked by other fish. And so that the flanker fish are supposed to distract you from seeing, and you respond more slowly when the fish is flanked by other fish. Okay, so this next test is a Corsi block style task where normally it would be three-dimensional and there would be blocks or squares, I guess, on a card. You could do it that way, but we're doing it obviously on the computer screen. It starts with just one square. One square lights up, and then you respond by tapping or clicking on the square that lights up. It starts with one square and it goes up to 10, which is impossible. But we do have a discontinuation rule, which we added because it's very long if you keep getting them. It's very long and very frustrating if you keep getting them wrong. But now if you get two wrong of the same length sequence, it discontinues and goes on to the next task. So it starts simply with one, and then it goes to two, and then it goes to, that's just two. Okay, and then I skipped over the middle ones, and it goes up to 10. I think this might be the 8 one. And it doesn't go this fast. I've speeded it up for the purposes of this presentation, but I'm sure you don't remember the order of the sequence, but Matthew got all this, the whole sequence correct. I find this to be the most challenging of all the tasks, but that could be me. Okay, so this is a task that's like the trail making task, which if you're familiar with traditional neuropsychology, you certainly have seen this before. And you connect, it's like connect the dots. So you start with numbers and you have to connect the dots in order. And if you make a mistake, there's a practice for every condition, and you're corrected if you make a mistake. This is speeded up. So you do numbers in order, and then you do letters in order. Speed it up. And then you do number, letter in order as fast as you can until you get to the end. You make a mistake, you get corrected. Okay, so the very last task is where you have to remember the cards again. You don't get any feedback, and you have to remember where all 14 cards are. And that is the end. And the very last screen, on the very last screen, we ask the parent to provide any feedback I'm not sure that we'll always include this screen, but for now it's been useful. We had, this is how we knew that the mom did the test instead of the child. And we've had a couple parents, you know, we're looking for things like, you know, the cat jumped on the keyboard or my child just couldn't do it and they gave up and ran away, you know, so that we know whether the data were validly collected. And that's it. That's the whole task. So we've collected so far 27 people ranging from 7 to 17 years. The average was 12 years. And so what we're as I said, we're working on trying to get the data flow from the actual task into something that's usable. But the other big thing that we need to work on is collecting normative data on the task so that we can actually, right now we'll be able to do, you know, look at alcohol versus control. But what we'd really like to do is be able to use this test as part of the screening process so that we can say that a child has impairments that we know are related to prenatal alcohol exposure. So, and the other thing we're doing is, you know, now that we have this task and we know it can be used effectively, we're looking for ways to make it useful to other people. We, you know, envision having it used in a clinical setting, not necessarily in a clinic because it does take about half an hour to 45 minutes, depending on the child, but perhaps at home before a child comes in for clinic. That's the way it's designed to be used. We're collecting, we're in the process of starting, in the IRB phase of projects where we're going to collect normative data from large numbers of unexposed children so that we have a comparison sample. So I'm hoping we have about a 67-68% response rate right now. And we're hoping it's, you know, I think, I don't know, some ways COVID makes this easier because people are at home. But on the other hand, they're spending so much time on screens that I think some parents are, you know, not really, we don't know this to be true, but, you know, as a parent, I can say we don't always want to do things that are going to encourage our kids to be on screens for more time than they already are. So we're collecting data at a steady rate, and we're working with Leah and Tatiana to put the Brain Online into the web portal. I've also talked with Jeff, and he's going to hopefully administer or send out the link to the subjects in his sample. So we're moving forward, and hopefully by December we'll have a little bit of data to show you.
Yeah. Thanks, Sarah. Appreciate it. It's pretty impressive. It's a nice job that you guys did.
So
I think it'll be interesting to see when we get data collected from it, and hopefully we can get enough normative data so you'll be able to make some sense of the FAA.
I have a quick question, and Sarah, we've talked about this, but I'm curious if you have any sense now when you're talking about reaction time or response latency of how variation in devices that people are using, how much variability there is from that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a good question. And definitely, you know, in my experience, collecting computerized data, it's something that we have thought about. But the test collects the device type that the person is using. So we'll be able to look at that and see and determine whether we think there's an issue. Right now, we originally had planned we really wanted this to be a mobile device that people could use on a phone, on a smartphone, but we elected instead to have it be administered on a laptop or an iPad with a keyboard. So you can do either of those things. It will not work on a smartphone, but it does work on a tablet with a keyboard. You have to have a keyboard. And so we'll be able to look at that. Whether there's a difference, for example, between tablets and keyboards or between different types of computers, things like that. So, yeah.
Any other questions?
Sarah, it's Jeff. Are you, I assume you're collecting time of day?
Yes, we do have time of day. We haven't prescribed a specific time of day for them to take the test, but we have that as part of the huge amount of data that comes out. We also know, we can't easily look at it, but we also know whether they take breaks in between, like if they, you know, go away and come back. But yeah, we'll be able to look at, I'm 90% certain we have that because we have date and time. Yeah, we should have that.
Yeah, when you do the normative, you may want to think about standardizing that because there are going to be big arousal effects and or fatigue effects.
Do you think it would be better to have everyone do it at about the same time or to have a...
Yeah, if your sample, is not going to be, you know, thousands, then yeah, you probably want to standardize it.
We're hoping to test 1,000 kids for the normative sample.
Yeah, you probably,
but I hadn't really thought about that for the normative sample.
You probably can't rely on people to take it at the same time of day always. I think you probably want some variability and just control for it.
Yeah, I'm up. Usually my practice is to record and look at.
Yeah, because people just don't do what you tell them to do.
Yeah.
Unless they're pressing questions. Leah, do you have any updates for the Data Access Committee?
We had one request come in. She is a researcher at Portland, and she studies heart outflow, and I think she's interested in the Ukraine data. So we're trying to work with her to see if we can get her.
And Sarah, anything on the Publications Committee?
Yes, I can tell you, or if there's time, I can show my slides.
2 minutes.
Okay, let me find it. Okay, I'm just going to tell you rather than show you. We didn't have any concept proposals come through. We had 2 papers that were accepted. I'm doing this from memory. Okay, we had 2 papers accepted. Jeff's group had a paper called Executive and Social Functioning Across Development. I'm sorry, these were submitted across development in children and adolescents with prenatal alcohol exposure. So that's exciting. And then we had a paper that we submitted on different measures of executive functioning, looking at inter-rater reliability, comparing parents and teachers and self-report, which hasn't been done before. And we actually just yesterday got our reviews back and they look addressable. So we're going to turn that around and hope to get that accepted soon. There was one paper accepted. Eileen Moore had a paper looking at spatial working memory across development. It was a cross-sectional study, but looked at the changes in spatial working memory over time and found that the unaltered trajectory where children with prenatal alcohol exposure didn't develop at the same rate as people who did not have that exposure. I can talk about this to you offline, Ed, about some other papers that we have seen come through the pipeline, but aren't coming through the process. But otherwise, please continue to submit your concept proposals and follow the process as we have proposed. Thank you.
All right, Bill, Joe, comments from NIAAA?
I don't have any other comments. Happy to field any questions.
Any questions for Bill or Joe? Okay then. The SAB, any comments, concerns? Dr. Hanning?
I have no comments or concerns. I know that Sarah Joe just had to leave. And I do look forward to seeing the progress reports, and any lead time we can get before the December meeting would be appreciated.
We will try to deal with that, John, as best we can.
I know it's hard to.
I would, if it's possible, I'd like the principal investigators, people who filled out that questionnaire, that we sent around to stay on. And if you didn't fill out the questionnaire or not on the science advisory board, if you could sign off, that would be great. All right, good night. Thank you, or good day, whatever it is, wherever you are. And everyone stay safe and be healthy, all right? And thanks, Therese, again. Appreciate it.
So did you say you wanted the SAB here or not?
Yeah, the SAB and the people who filled out those questionnaires regarding going into an extension and how much money you were going to have left over.
Okay, I'll be right back.
All right. So everyone filled those out, and I really appreciate that. We put everything together. I sent in things, and this was